Welcome to Greenside Up right here on the mighty 690K GGF. In studio with us today, we have Jacob Weber and Adavin Skrontz. Guys, how are you doing this morning?
Good morning.
Good morning. Doing good.
All right. So, hey, going to talk about a lot of things today. And one of the first things we want to talk about, because the weather is getting colder. In fact, this Friday, it's supposed to drop like a rock. We're looking maybe at our first frost.
First frost coming in. And of course, we got some things out in the garden yet. Tomatoes, possibly, if they survived all the rain without leaf blight. And maybe bell peppers and maybe sweet potatoes. I have sweet potatoes in my garden. And, of course, that's that first frost, when it's blackens the leaves of the sweet potatoes, that signals it's the time to dig them and get them out of the garden. Of course, sweet potatoes can be dug anytime they're large enough to make a decent root, or a decent meal, instead of little skinny little things. We're getting close to that time. I just let mine go until the last possible moment, because they get a little bit bigger root. It's not really a tuber. It's actually a swollen root tissue. But sweet potatoes do need to be dug before the soil temperature drops down into the mid-50s, and that's going to be a while yet. Of course, plant itself is very frost tender, and it doesn't take much of a cold temperature to turn the leaves black. And once the leaves are damaged, that's the end of the production of carbohydrates that are going to go into making the roots larger. So it's time to get them out of the garden. But sweet potatoes are a little different than Irish potato. They need to go through a curing process after they're dug. And that takes about 2 or 3 weeks. And Irish potatoes, you want to cure those too, or let them at least rest for 24 to 48 hours so they developed a little wound healing tissue called suberin. But sweet potatoes, they need to develop a tough skin, outer skin. When you dig sweet potatoes, that outer skin is very tender. It doesn't take much to really damage it. So, there's going to be a little bit of soil attached to those roots. And what you want to do is just gently wash off the soil. Maybe use a soft cloth to help clean the root. And then allow them to kind of air dry a little bit, not much. But the curing process requires warm temperatures, the temperatures 75 to 85 degrees, and high humidity, around 80 to 90% relative humidity. And we're going to keep those sweet potatoes stored under that environmental condition for at least 2 weeks, possibly three. During that period of time, there's going to be a little conversion of starchy material to sugary material, a sweeter tasting sweet potato root, and also the development of that tough outer skin that allows that root to remain in storage for up to 9 months easily. Once they're cured, then the sweet potato roots are going to be stored approximately 60-65 degrees Fahrenheit. You do not want to store sweet potatoes any cooler than 55 degrees, because at that point they're going to start developing tissue damage as a result of cooler temperatures. That's a chilling injury on the root. They're a tropical plant, and they do require warmer conditions for storage. So that's a little different than the Irish potato, which we would store probably about 45 to 50 degrees, 45 under high relative humidity conditions for the Irish potato. Sweet potatoes don't need to be stored quite that high of humidity. They can be in a regular house or room temperature, but they just need to go through the curing process to get them conditioned so they will stay very good in storage.
So, yeah, I definitely want to make sure those sweet potatoes, because I love me some sweet potatoes myself. So, also, one more thing before we get over to Davin. Last chance to plant fescue.
Turf grass. We're getting to mid-October. That's usually the cutoff date for the planting fescue grass seed. The plant itself, when that grass germinates and comes up, it has to develop its secondary root system. We think of a primary root system on plants as being the main root system. But fescue or grass plants, actually, their main root system is called a secondary root system. It develops adventitiously from that first and second node that are produced right as the little shoot comes out of the soil. That shoot's called a coleoptile. It opens up into the first leaves, but there it develops a little node right there at the soil line, and from that point adventitious roots start to grow. And that's really what needs to develop in that grass plant before we get into winter, because that grass plant generally will not survive if it has to survive on its primary root, which is very weak, poorly attached to the main part of the plant. It's just there to get the plant started, so we need enough time, enough growing season in the remaining in the fall for those grass plants to grow sufficiently well, develop a good secondary root system so they can go into the winter and survive the winter. So we're coming up that time. It's time to get the seed in if you haven't done it already.
Absolutely. Davin, of course, as the weather is getting colder, the mice and rats decide they want to move in because they want to get out of the cold as well.
Yes, with the cooler weather, you may be getting some unwanted house guests in the form of mice and rats. And they are nocturnal, which means they move around the most at night. So you probably won't notice them at first, but you can look for signs of them that they've been in your home or other outbuildings and are moving around, so you can stop them before they really make themselves at home and get comfortable. Most of the time they'll move along the same route and they'll make a defined trail that will show up in dusty areas. But of course, if it's in your home or somewhere where there's not a lot of dust and you think they may be moving around, you can sprinkle some flour. That way, if they move through, you can see sign that they're moving around and kind of get an idea of where to set the mouse traps. And of course, the most common sign you'll probably see, and one for sure way to know they're around, is you'll see fresh mouse and rat droppings around, and then you definitely know they've moved into the building. So to kind of deter them from coming into your home or other buildings, you can try and eliminate dense vegetation, piles of wood, or other stored materials from around the outside of your home or other buildings, because these are things that attract them as potential homes for the winter. And then, of course, rodent proofing your home or barn or garage. It's never possible, unfortunately, to completely rodent proof your building so they can't come in. But you can make sure openings around pipes and floor drains are sealed, and any openings that are a half inch or smaller are sealed up. And then, of course, eliminating any food or water sources in the area. So if it's your home, making sure the pantry, the food in there, is stored in tight containers where they can't chew through boxes and get to it, and that dog food or maybe bird seed is stored in trash cans so they can't get in there and have an all-you-can-eat buffet and figure out that, hey, this is a good source of food, we want to come back here. And then also clean up, kind of with cleaning up gardens, also cleaning up those fruits and nuts, seed pods, anything that has been blown off trees that might be around your home. Keeping all that cleaned up will also help keep them away from your house, hopefully. And then, of course, to directly reduce mice and rats, place traps out, because if a mouse or a rat has found their home in your home, then chances are their friends will quickly find out and they may have visitors.
Yeah, we don't want any visitors. We don't want any mouse friends moving in. One of the things I used to do at one of the last places I used to live at that helped keep mice out was stuffing steel wool into like whole areas that they could possibly come in, because obviously they can't chew through steel. So.
Yeah, exactly. And they may try, but it's not going to work out very good.
It's going to tear their teeth up. it is we're going to start seeing a lot more deer moving around, because it is mating season for deers. In fact, I was telling you guys just before we came on the air that I came across three deer on the road just a little north of here, and I had to stop because they just looked at me until I honked the horn before they decided to just kind of mosey off the road. But they will be moving around quite a bit more now.
Yes. Fall, October through about January is the typical breeding season for deer. Around here, we have a lot of white-tailed deer, and they have a pretty big area that they cover. Generally, it usually is about 1 square mile. So they cover a lot of ground, and then with it being breeding season, they're going to be a lot more active. So you'll see them a lot more, and like we were talking about before we came on the air, they move around more in the early morning and evening hours. So I've seen a couple on my way to work. So you definitely want to be careful if you're driving in the early morning or dusk in the evening to keep your eye out for them, because they are moving around more, which means they're more likely to be close to the roads or crossing the roads.
Yeah, and the other thing I told you, that it was at near a crest, so if it had been night, I probably would have hit them because I wouldn't have been able to see them at night. So, yeah, you got to really watch out during those times, because they'll just hop on out, you know, and it usually ends up bad for both the deer and your car.
Yes, definitely. It just ends up being a bad situation all the way around.
So anyway, but okay, guys, what we're going to do, we're going to go ahead and take a break. We're going to do some news. And then when we come back, we'll be talking a little more about maybe some compost making, and also some stable flies, because stable flies are not good. As you guys were saying, they're kind of just, they kind of hang around a little bit, and they're kind of a nuisance. All right, let's go ahead and take the break. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF. And we are back on Green Side Up as we welcome back into studio Jacob Weber and David Skrontz. And Jacob, a few other things we were wanting to talk about as I try to get your mic on.
Okay.
Compost making.
Compost. Yeah, we're in that time of the year when leaves are going to start falling off the tree, but we're not quite there yet. We're kind of waiting for the fall color to develop, and hopefully we don't get a hard freeze before that happens. So, compost, good way to get rid of yard waste. Number one, and that's a very practical way. I guess burning may be the more preferred way for some folks. Compost making is not without a little bit of effort, but compost itself is a good product and a good soil amendment. So for the avid gardener, this is a great thing to do. Compost making is extremely simple, but there have been volumes of books written about making compost, and it's more philosophical and ideological. You know, the compost is the natural process. It's just the fungi and bacteria and other organisms just breaking down organic residues into a very usable product. So, to make a long story short, what you need for compost making is compostable materials. That includes leaves and garden and yard debris, flower beds, flowers, dead plants, Let's skip the dead animals. Let's skip, you know, some certain products that maybe come out of the house, oily products, cheese, things like that. We kind of like to keep those products out of the compost pile. And number one is that they could create a foul odor. That'd be pretty bad. Decaying meat is not good. And then also it can attract the rats and mice that David was talking about. So let's keep that stuff out of the compost pile. Now I do put eggshells in my compost, but some folks say keep it out. I don't have never had any issue with that, but peels from carrots and potatoes, things like that, can go into compost very easily. So we got the compostable material, leaves and stuff. There are different types of materials that we want to think of. We want to separate, well, we don't have to separate them out, but we just have to get an idea. And some organic residues have a lot of nitrogen, like fresh grass clippings, and some organic residues have a lot of carbon material but very little nitrogen, and that would be like dried leaves and straw and sawdust. So the high carbon material does not compost very easily, very readily. It takes a lot longer time for that to happen. Whereas your fresh grass clippings, you put them in a pile and they're going to heat up and decompose very rapidly. In fact, maybe so fast that they produce kind of an unpleasant odor and maybe give off a little bit of ammonia and other volatile or organic chemicals that kind of smell pretty bad. So if we blend the green material and the brown material, the green material being high nitrogen, the brown material being a high carbon material, if we blend those together and kind of get a nice mixture of the two, we can have a compost that's going to decompose a lot faster and without the issues of producing the foul odors and the loss of nitrogen from the pile. So, you know, there's times of the year when we have an abundance of green material, and there's times of the year when we have abundance of brown material. So if we can take that green material and blend it into the brown material as we have it, that would work. So you accumulate the leaves and other brown materials in your compost pile. They don't decompose very fast the following spring and summer. If you got grass clippings and other green materials that would help speed up that process, you can blend those into the compost pile and speed up the composting process. Or if you have a lot of brown material and you want to speed up the process, you just add a little bit of nitrogen fertilizer. That works very well. About a half a cup to a cup of urea for a compost pile, 5 foot by 5 foot by 5 foot, would work very well. And that's loose brown material. It's not really highly compacted material. So a good a pile of leaves, big pile of leaves, probably as much as it come off of a tree or two, a large tree or two, you could just add a little bit of nitrogen fertilizer. You don't have to use urea. You can use blood meal, or you can use like turf grass fertilizer without any type of weed killer or weed preventer in it. It works great. You just may have to use a little bit more, but it's kind of a do it by guess a little bit, and you can speed up the composting process. Another thing that you need for compost making is water, moisture. The microbes have to have a film of water or at least moisture on the material in order to start working. This decomposition always occurs with the presence of moisture. If it's a dry material, very dry, you're going to have to moisten it, and maybe moisten it several times so it gets that nice flexible moist texture to it, and then you can start the composting process a little bit easier. If you want to make compost faster, you can chop the materials up into smaller pieces, because the smaller the pieces are, the greater the surface area is of the material. And the greater the surface area is, the greater ability for microbes to really spread out and work faster. So folks that really like to brag about making compost fast, they cheat by chopping everything up. Of course, when you do that, you have to have a power equipment. That means that you're going to be consuming materials that are going to put more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which is unnecessary. So you can just give the compost pile a little bit more time to do the job, and it works fairly fast. Another ingredient in a compost pile is oxygen, air. Microbes that we want to do the decomposition process are aerobic organisms. They need oxygen for their respiration, and so we're going to need a little bit of oxygen in the pile. We don't have to worry too much about it, because oxygen does diffuse into the pile as the microbes consume the organic residues. They're going to give off carbon dioxide, diffusion. If you've been in chemistry in high school or something like that, you're going to learn about diffusion. The concentration of a gas in one area is going to disperse into the entire room, so that it reaches an equilibrium. When the compost pile is producing a lot of carbon dioxide, at the equilibrium is to the point where the carbon dioxide is going to diffuse out, because the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is much less than it is in the pile. And then on the vice versa, as the oxygen level in the pile goes down lower — this is a chemistry lesson, by the way — It's going to move back into the oxygen is going to diffuse back into the pile. So unless the pile is extremely compacted or it is extremely soggy, we're going to have aerobic decomposition. Now, if you have a situation where it's just really compacted and really saturated with water, you make convert to anaerobic decomposition, which also occurs. And the byproduct of anaerobic decomposition is methane, which is flammable. Of course, you're not going to get enough concentration for anything to blow up, but you're also going to get some pretty stinky odors produced, and it's going to smell like a sewer. So we don't want that. You really have to work hard in order to get the anaerobic decomposition to take place. So we don't worry about that much at all. We're going to have plenty of air in that compost pile. One of the things we want to do, though, is we want to turn that pile every now and then, maybe once every 2 weeks. And the purpose of that is to move the material from the outside that hasn't been decomposing very well. And we're going to put that on the inside and move the stuff that's on the inside to the outside, so we keep that rotation going, so we get a better compost. And let's see, we talked about air, we talked about water, we talked about bringing bound materials. There's one more ingredient, and that's patience, time. We have to give the compost pile time to do the process of breaking things down. I guess I should throw in one more ingredient, and it's temperature. Ambient temperature. Compost does not take place when it's freezing. When that pile is frozen, it's not going to work. So we're going to have to wait until things warm up in the spring, maybe. If we start a compost pile in the fall, it may not be sufficient that it generates its own heat to where it can decompose quickly, because the pile may be too small. If we get a really large pile, it will trap that heat, and it will have decomposition taking place in the center of the pile, not on the outside, and we turn the pile. Eventually, that pile is going to chill, and we will not get any further decomposition until we get ambient air temperatures up into about 50, 60 degree range, 70, 80 degrees, and then it works a lot better and a lot faster. So most of the composting process is going to occur during the summer months. And then once the compost is finished, then we can return it back to the garden or to the flower bed or to the lawn. Good product. It'll be rapidly used by soil organisms, earthworms, and other critters, and they're going to move that material back into the soil. They're going to consume it and turn it into a very rich material that's going to improve the soil's structure and return a lot of those plant nutrients that are in the pile back into the ground. It's not a terribly rich fertilizer. Actually, it's fairly poor, but the ability for that organic residues to improve the quality of the soil is tremendous. So after a number of years, you really have a good garden soil by composting.
I got to turn myself up a little bit. We were talking about animals moving in because it's cold. We were also talking about stable flies, and they can be kind of a nuisance.
Davin, you want to jump
in? Yeah, Davin, sorry, I meant to point to you. So
no, that's okay. Yeah, so stable flies, they're more commonly outside around barns, livestock, horses. Usually they are a pest to livestock and horses and bother them all throughout the summer and fall, or not just horses, but other livestock as well. So typically they're outside, but just like mice and rats and kind of everything we've been talking about today is related to the temperature cooling off with it being fall. So as the temperature cools down, they're gonna start trying to come into your house because it's basically their last ditch effort to try and survive the winter. As they come into your home, you'll kind of experience how annoying they can be and kind of be able to commiserate with the livestock that we're putting up with them throughout the summers.
That's when you get the fly swatters out and go to work, because they can be all over the place.
Fly swatter or just an aerosol spray, you know, that contains pyrethrin. It's mm-hmm. a quick knockdown, and then a vacuum cleaner and clean them up.
Yep, and it just takes one little spray and mist and knocks them out.
Thinking of insects that are a nuisance that tend to move indoors during the fall and winter is the multicolored Asian lady beetle. And they have a bad habit. They like to accumulate, move indoors. And they're, of course, a very beneficial insect. They do eat a lot of aphids and other critters that tend to be a pest of us. But they like to overwinter, and not just a few of them, but once they find a good spot, they give off an odor that attracts more and more and more and more, and pretty soon you're going to have upwards of thousands of them. Depending on your structure, if they find a place to get in, they'll get in, and they are a real nuisance once indoors. The best thing to do for them is a vacuum cleaner. Suck them up and put them in a bag and get out of the house. I don't feel too bad about getting rid of those critters because they have a tendency to be a real nuisance, and when they congregate in large numbers, they can stink pretty bad. But fortunately, we've had them try moving in every year, and we have to get rid of a few of them as they move in. They like to move in between the wall spaces, up in the attic, and occasionally you will find a whole bunch of them just laying dead because they don't survive the winter very well at all. Multicolored Asian lady beetle. This is we call it a pest. It's a nuisance at certain times. It's not really a pest, but it's a nuisance. And it's an insect that has been introduced to our country for purposes of managing certain insect pests. And it turned out to be a little bit more than what we were bargaining for. So, and they're here.
And they like to congregate in large numbers, like you said.
Yeah.
You get one, and then they put out the scent, and They all come running to kind of hang out. And yep. That's not a good thing if they get inside your house or something like that.
I think they probably like when they get a card party go on and a little bit of music or Asian ladybug music, and they're really just having a good old time there.
And so you put it into the party and get them out of there. All right. Well, guys, I do thank you very much for coming in today. It's been really interesting, especially hearing about the composting. Because I'll probably start doing some of that with my little area as well, because man, the grass is kind of, it's not very great, and the soil I can tell is not very great either. It's kind of just it's just dirt.
So it's a good thing for gardeners. It's not compost making is not for everybody.
Right.
So.
Okay. Well, again, guys, thank you very much for coming in today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, that was Green Side Up with Jacob Weber and David Skrontz. And if you want to listen to this again later on, or if you haven't listened to it yet, you'll be able to hear it online later on today. You are listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF.